you say more about how surrender was what you thought it would be?
Yeah. Well, there is this concept that you surrender your will to God. And I would have said I was surrendered, you know. You know, I was doing everything that I thought you did in a surrendered kind of state. But any time a resistance comes up, I know that I'm not surrendered. And I would say the word that I can use best to describe the surrendered state is when I am just being. I just sit and be, and I'm empty and still. There's nothing about what am I having for dinner, or this needs to be done, or... And in this surrendered state, you're taken, is the only way that I can... There's this just tremendous pull, so that you actually leave any sense that you have of yourself. But the only way you can do that is through surrender. And these resistances show you if you are or not. And for me now, I can still resist, usually my heart closes down, I become really dim. I have to really look at, you know, what it was all about. Did it have any reality, or only the reality that I gave it? You know, something put me out of joint. And it usually has to do with, you know, a concept that's been presented to me as being true. And my experience has showed me that it's part of the lie. But yet, for some reason, I'm being asked to live this lie again, and I don't understand that. So, you know, I have to, you know, go through the whole process of bringing light into that and, you know, surrendering and seeing what comes from that surrendered place. With this surrender, there was this war that was going on. And it's hard to describe what the war was actually about, other than in this reality, you see what war is about. You know, people want power. It has to do around economics or politics or whatever. In a way, that goes on within as well. You want your own way still, and you're not getting it. So you are going to put up this fight, and you're going to give all the reasons why you think you're right. And that's what I would use. And why I thought I was right was because of a system of belief that, you know, I had embraced in this reality. And it was a true enough belief system to at least get me to a place where I knew some of the things that I had to do so that, you know, the grace would come. But at some point, you know, with just all of this fighting and, you know, thinking this is true and it wasn't true, and there was always this deeper meaning and more dismantling, and you think there's absolutely nothing of yourself left, and there you're shown, you know, how much more there still is that has to go. And then at some point, you know, I just couldn't fight anymore. I was just exhausted by the fighting. And I had this experience where my whole chest just opened up and it became full of light. And I was standing there and I had this sword, two-edged sword, hanging from my hand, and it was full of jewels, and the sword was taken from me and it was put in my heart, and I was told that I no longer had to fight in this way, that all those things had been conquered now. And in that moment, I just said that I'll take everything that I know to be true, and I'm putting it in my heart, and I'm going to live from there. And that's when the surrender came. And it's an experience. For me, it was an experience that I had. And you're taking into what I call the beyond. There is no concept that I can say other than it's the beyond. It's beyond any concept that you have. And you're gone. You know, you have many deaths on this path. And for me, they were very real. A death by fire, a death by suffocation, a death by drowning. So air, water. I don't know how it is for other people, but you are giving your life to God over again and over again and over again. And it's all this thing where, you know, give your breath to the one that owns your life. It's an experience. I mean, a lot of these beautiful poems that you're reading, these are people's experiences that they have when they go into the unseen. You know, they're speaking from a place of knowing with certainty because they've actually had the experience. There are some people that can speak to you theoretically because they have knowledge of it from their path. And there are some people that speak to you because they've had these experiences. I don't know if that answers your question or not. But you do know that it's not your will any longer when you have surrendered. And you have these moments where you think you're surrendered, and then it becomes very obvious that your will is still at work as you make your journey. And then at some point, you just know it's not your will anymore, that you have actually given it up. I would say give it up as early in the process as you can. If you have the opportunity, do it the first time. Yeah.
Do you seem very different to people who knew you before and after this transition? Do you seem different now to people that knew you, and how do you and they deal with that?
I think for some people, yes. And for other people, I'm not sure. I would say some people say I'm softer now. I'm a kinder, gentler person. I would say that I'm not as present as I used to be. But perhaps when I'm present now, it's, you know, like sometimes you can be speaking to me and I'm but I'm really somewhere else. And some people notice that and some people don't. But there's a few people here who knew me. My cousin Eugenie, she might be able to tell you a little bit about that. She's known me my whole life. She saw me at the best times and the worst times.
Things change, things stay the same. She's still a little child.
Oh yeah, there's this child that gets born in the heart when you decide to relinquish your identity. There's this beautiful, beautiful child waiting that you become. It was difficult in the beginning because I had to remember, this child had to remember what I knew as an adult so that I could still function here. So I had many experiences about having to learn how to do basic things again. And I have one experience that I like to tell, where I used to have this very active, busy life, and I flew all over the place for my work, and I was very familiar with airports, rental cars, whatever. And the first time I had to take an airplane after this experience I had, it was like, oh, there's just no way. I mean, I could hardly get down the block to get a bowl of soup and get back to my house without something going on. So, and it was going to be my first working experience after a long time. So I get to the airport, I get on the plane, everything's fine. I land in Los Angeles, and it's pouring down, raining. And my car rental service, it's called the Emerald Isle. And you get in this huge bus with all these other people, and they take you to this Emerald Isle, and you get off, and there's this sea of cars, and they tell you, just go pick one. Well, I hadn't made a choice of my own in so long, and I was standing there, it's pouring down, raining, I'm all wet, and I'm like, and I'm crying because I didn't know how to make a choice anymore for a rental car. So I get in the car, and I'm like, okay, I have to drive now. And so you start the whole thing. Okay, I used to know how to drive. I used to drive all the time. Okay, I'm going to drive. You know, so you start up the car and you drive off and you do your business. And on the way back to the airport to return the rental car, I was pretty out of it. And there was an accident. So the traffic was stopped, and I had an airplane to catch, and I had no concept about time yet. Couldn't get back into minutes, hours, days, weeks yet. And I'm actually sitting in this rental car thinking that it would be okay for me to take my car, go on the sidewalk, pass all these cars, get around the ambulance, avoid the police, and go on my way to the airport. And I had hours, because I allowed hours to get to the airport, because I knew that it could take a while. But there's this part of you that's going, no, Lynn, you can't get on the sidewalk. And so it's a little scary when you start trying to integrate, you know, the two realities. But it all works out. There's this grace, love protecting you, and I'm really a good driver, but it's all a journey.
Do you feel you had any real choice in this? I mean, we all have free will and all that, but do you honestly feel you had any real choice in this?
In the beginning, yes. I do feel that I had a choice. And then at some point, no. After I had said yes, no, you're just taken. That's how it was for me anyway.
Was it very far into the journey that happened, or
was it near the beginning for you?
Well, it's when I made the decision to sit in meditation is when it happened for me. I had always had a contemplative practice. I never sat in meditation. So the first time I sat in meditation was my yes. I don't know how it is for other people.
Did you at some point, or was it at the very beginning, not care what other people thought about you in terms of this experience or this journey, or did you always feel that way about yourself?
Actually, I would say after the experience, I had a little bit of a problem with how, because people had such a preconceived idea of, you know, how you should be and what you should, how you should act and what you should look like, and I had more of a problem before. I'm just like everyone who sits in this room, as far as I'm concerned. I mean, this concept around a sheikh and a guru and all of, I didn't know anything about that. There was just a teacher within, and that's what I always, and through my studies, I had a teacher, but I was a self-taught student, but it isn't, you know, a teacher like when you say you have a sheikh or a guru. It isn't that at all.
So you never had one?
Mm-mm. Well, like I said, there is this inner guide.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there is a true teacher, and it's within. Now, other people may. But I do think in this reality, there are very wise people who can guide you along the way. There are practices that you can do that help with the discipline, and, you know, there are things that bring light into your heart. But I also know that this is all within as well.
I have one more question. I've noticed in myself and in other people that the more you walk along the path, the softer your heart is, mm-hmm. and the more vulnerable mm-hmm. and the more tender it becomes. And things, for example, like the war in Afghanistan mm-hmm. and the killing has, on my heart and others, I'm sure, has had even a physical effect of weightiness and a physical heaviness, as well as an emotional and a spiritual effect, and a sadness that I can even feel physically a lot of the time. It makes me very tired. I don't know if you live in the desert, if you know all about those things, but that is probably a normal effect of walking on a spiritual path. Is that correct? Or
well, I think we all have a great deal of compassion for each other. And
we're all one, and so yeah. We feel what yeah. those people are feeling. Is that what happens?
I think it's probably very individual. Some people feel less, some people feel more.
Could you talk more about the craziness that led you to the Nachabandi
thing? Well, there's this concept, the intoxicated Sufi. Well, that was kind of how I was. I was in a constant state of remembrance. But having a difficult time functioning here. and it was obvious that I was to become sober. And it's hard to, well, I'll explain one experience that will maybe let you know what I mean by intoxicated. I went to a restaurant, a neighborhood restaurant, and even getting to the restaurant would be an effort for me. I was living in New York City at the time, and I was worried that a taxi would hit me or a bus would hit me. 'Cause you're here, but you're not exactly here. So I got to the restaurant and I ordered my food to go, and I went after lunch so it wouldn't be too busy, and I know I ordered my food, and I'm standing there and I'm waiting for my food, and in like an instant I was gone, just totally gone. And I came back to this reality with the wait staff going, "Lady, lady, hello, lady." You know, so you can't, you know, function that way in America. Maybe if you're living in India or someplace else where, you know, they have a lot of intoxicated Sufis, it's fine. But people do not understand that here. You know, and so I did come back to this reality, but, you know, and I was past the point of being embarrassed by anything that happened to me by then, so, you know, I just took my food and left. But so it's that kind of thing. No, I had no control. I still have no control over. I have this idea of containment where I try to stay in containment. Otherwise, you know, because the baraka, which is the energy of the path, it comes pretty strongly sometimes, and it really works on your heart, and you just want to cry sometimes. But it's a kind of crying that isn't just, you know, a little Kleenex. It's like this huge mess by the time you finish. You know, everything's all wet, and, you know, you kind of made a lot of strange noises, and, you know, it comes from a depth that, you know, you might not be familiar with yet, but you do become familiar with, because your tears begin to come from a place really deep within inside yourself. So I try to stay in containment now, even when I'm at home. Integrated.
If we are supposed to,
everybody in humanity is supposed to take this journey.
Yes.
Why it is so difficult? Because everybody who has been described the pain and suffering which goes along with this, are there other ways by which it is faster, easier?
Actually, I don't think anyone has sufficiently described the suffering or the pain. These beautiful poems that you all are reading, only Allah knows that. I mean, maybe some people haven't suffered at all, but...
Because the whole humanity is supposed to do that. Is our resistance which makes it difficult?
Yes,
or if you just let go?
Yes. Or we have a belief system, a structure that we built that is our identity. You have to dismantle that. I mean, I had this beautiful house of cards that I actually went in and took one of them, and the whole house fell down. And I actually thought just things that were not true would fall, and then I could put, you know, a brick here and a brick there or whatever, but the whole thing collapsed. And I didn't realize even it seems to always be a relative truth. And it might be better than the truth you had before, but it still seems to stay relative.
So, like,
until there's just no house, you just don't try to even build one again. You're just like, why bother?
Somebody who has been through can help others. That's the role of a sheikh or a guide, to make it easier and let you know what to expect.
Yeah. I think they help with your resistance. They see obstacles that are coming your way, and they can help you to see that it is an obstacle. Because sometimes you're not aware that it's an obstacle. You know, you'll get this inspiration that, oh, if I'll do this, then I'll have more time for my spiritual practice and whatever. And before you know it, you have no time at all for your spiritual practice, because you have imposed your will on, you know, something perhaps, when actually the way things were was perfectly fine. But you thought you could make it better if you did this or this or this. And it doesn't always turn out to be that way. So, like you said, a teacher or a sheikh can sometimes help you not decide to go in a direction that you're thinking about going in. You know, they can let you know that be content with where you're sitting. You know, it'll all happen from there. But I don't actually know how sheikhs or teachers really work.
The literature for the last thousands of years is full of these.
Yeah. Because like I said, for me there's one teacher. And it all comes from within, so. But I've had a lot of help on my journey from the elders, from the unseen. If you ask, there's a lot of help. That is given along the way.
Practical note, were you able to hold down a job and so forth while you were surrendering?
For a while, no. But fortunately, I had very good credit and a huge extension on my credit cards. So for a couple of years, I lived on my credit cards. And then I was able to go back to work, and everything worked out fine. And I still work now sometimes, not anywhere like, I mean, that totally changed. But I still work sometimes whenever money seems to be needed. So you're provided for. That actually was the least scary part of it all. I didn't concern myself with too much about, you know, how I was going to pay my rent. Or actually, that part was scarier when I only really you know, when I first started my own business and all of that. So after the experience, all of that became much easier.
There was some sort of relation between the suffering and the joy that made it possible for you to continue.
The question was, do you remember whether there was some sort of relation between the suffering and the joy that made it possible for you to continue?
I would say for me, sometimes the suffering was the confusion that I had, because I didn't know what happened to me was even a possibility. All of you all have heard about mystical experiences, and you know, you probably all know a little bit about that. That wasn't part of my reality at all, so it was a huge shock for me. Even the first time I had a vision, it was a huge shock for me. But I had a curiosity in a way, even though, you know, I would get pulverized in this whole process. A curiosity of, well, what's next? You know, is there more, or was that it? At some point, every time I just sat in meditation, I mean, it was just something was always happening. And the suffering and the joy, they're kind of just right there together. It's not like they're, you know, I had one over here and one over here. They were kind of both the same, because you had such a sense of expansion when whatever you were in the midst of was over. You know, it was kind of just this, whoa, that burden's gone. And we do carry a lot of stuff, a lot of burdens. And there is this, you know, along this journey, there is this ecstatic, blissful state. And I would say a lot of people can just stay there, because it is very beautiful. You know, it's very alluring. But for some reason, you know, from within, I knew that I was to keep moving, that I wasn't to stay in anywhere. And I think this went back to one of the original visions that I had of this bird in the cage. When that cage was shut and the cage disappeared, I knew that I would always be flying, that I wasn't going to be, you know, staying any particular place again. So it's a constant movement in a way. And, you know, sometimes I still get, you know, the energy, you know, throws me into something that I'm not comfortable with. And I don't always know what it is now. In the beginning, it was very clear, you know, that I was giving up a concept or an idea or a belief system. But now it isn't always clear why I'm disturbed. Sit. You just sit. That's it. And you wait for it to pass.
Level, do you maintain some sort of attention to your breath in some way?
on a day-to-day level, like wake now, or doing some activity, do you maintain a type of attention on your breath to help keep you in touch with your heart?
No, I don't. But I can understand that it's a useful practice. With the experience that I had, my breath was changed, and I just sit with that change. So I don't mess with anything. But I understand when you know, they speak about doing that, I understand why they're giving that practice, because something does happen to your breath.
Because it seems like if you forget your breath, you'll have a propensity to go back to whatever, well, like if you're moody, you'll go back to being more moody. If your synapses are firing off a lot, you'll have a tendency to go off into your synapses. So it seems like some degree of breath, connection to the breath, is necessary to maintain the tie to the heart, to keep the joy, and also to avoid it being so sorrowful.
Well, I just, like I said, I just sit with what was given.
Do you believe that besides speaking to others that you receive any special gifts on this journey? Like some people get the gift of healing.
You're given many, many gifts. People are showing up and woofing things on you and giving. And for me, I felt they would be an obstacle. And that was only for me, that it felt like it could be a stopping place.
What, I'm sorry, I asked about gifts and I couldn't hear what you said.
You're given many gifts along the way.
For others or for?
Well, your concept of other disappears. So, I'm assuming this gift it's a gift and it's available. But for myself, I just kept moving. And felt that if I ever needed to be any of these things that these gifts were, that in that moment I would be able to, but I was never attracted to the gifts. It wasn't the destination that I was seeking. I mean, I knew I had a long journey. So I just kept moving.
So that others isn't a reality for you because of our oneness?
It's one of the things, and for me, that went. God is all there is.
Pardon?
God is all there is.
Sometimes I feel a deep sense of shame in because of the separation from God. Did you ever experience that?
No. Shame and guilt, they were never a part of my understanding of God, self, or life. But I have met people, you know, who have had a similar feeling. But for myself, I've never known that. I would say it's a concept that you have, and it's one of the things that you'll have to dismantle. I mean, I would ask you, why would you feel shame? But, you know, again, this is where I say if you go within and you ask yourself this question, you know, you may perhaps, you know, begin to dismantle that idea. Or you could ask one of these sheikhs that are here if they know something about this. Because I think it has probably something to do around teaching your question. You know, that they...
What do you mean around teaching? Did you mean like religious teaching, for example?
Yeah, or...
In my case, I didn't have any religious upbringing, really, but it's as if it's something that just arises.
Yeah.
I don't know from where.
Well, I know sometimes people think that they're not worthy of the journey, or, you know, God is so much greater, and I'm just this small, you know, or... I mean, there's psychology around it, maybe. I don't really... But... Like I said, I would go within and ask what it's about. You might find an answer.
Thanks.
One heart, one God.
I'm interested to know, since you've had these experiences, how has your concept of your own service changed? How do you feel that you're now a better servant of God after being going through this, besides the fact that you're sharing it with us, which is a very nice thing to do?
I would say that use is a better word now for me than service. Of use. I still don't exactly know, you know, what the picture will look like, if there even will be one. But I've been given things have been revealed to me about a particular work that's to be done. And it has a life of its own, and I try to stay out of its way. And so far I haven't really spoken about it, and I don't know if I will. I'm sure at some point if it is to be, you know, spoken about, it will. So it's more like now it's of use, not so much of service. I'm just used. You know, you just sit and you be and you're used. And, I mean, you don't really know always what it's about. It's just in the sitting, I would say, is the use. You know, again, back to that quiet, empty place and consciousness, and you emanate from there. I would say that I was sent, and I don't know if that makes sense to you or not, but I had asked for help in the unseen, because, like I said, I was in a rather bewildered and confused state, and I was in a state of remembrance. But it was very hard for me to function in this reality.
Did this state defend it?
Yes. So I asked for help. And I had looked for a little while for someone in America. I actually asked friends, if you know of a sheikh or a guru or anyone that could help me to understand what had happened to me, I'd appreciate it. But I found that theoretically I could find people, you know, that could talk to me about what happened to me. But I had a very difficult time finding anyone who had actually had any experience. And I wanted someone who experientially knew what I was talking about when I, you know, went to see them. And so I, you know, and actually the first time, well, I had made plans to go see my sheikh in London. And before I was going, I got a phone call. Don't come, he's not going to see you. So, you know, the typical Sufi story of, you know, being difficult to get to the sheikh, that happened to me. But I got on the airplane and went anyway. So, scent, you know. You know, fluke. You know, you can't, I mean, how would I ever meet a Indian sheikh?
Lynn, do you think that we should try and encourage people to go on a spiritual journey, or should we just let them follow their own path and their own road or their own way?
At one time, I would have told everyone to head for the door, find someone you really love, get a job you really enjoy, raise a nice family. But no, it's a beautiful journey. And it's a never, I mean, it's an infinite, eternal, I mean, it's still going on. It's what we're here to do, I think. You know, to know and feel what God, self, and life is. No, but sometimes you see people, you know, in the Sufis talk about the idea of going fishing. You know, you see people that, you know, are ripe or ready. And they just need a little encouragement. And, you know, a lot of you know people that, you know, have a presence that you, you know, that they sit in the grace. And, you know, if you could introduce them to someone that, you know, you feel has journeyed on the path. I mean, if there isn't a sheikh or a guru or a monk or a sage or, you know, to go to. I mean, you know, I don't, you know, really know what everyone's journey is to be. I just know that there is a journey for everyone and there is a way for everyone. And I know that there's a teacher within for everyone. And perhaps in this reality, there is a teacher for everyone as well. But I do know that for most of us, you know, our awareness is so often somewhere else that, you know, you could sit and have dinner with your guru and not even know it. You know? You know, unless it was meant to be. But for me, it's always interesting stories when people talk about how they got to their studies or how they met their sheikh or how they met their guru or how they, you know, discovered the teacher within. Or
is it not yet time to speak about this unknown chi?
It didn't seem like it was.
Sorry? Sorry?
It didn't seem like it was.
And now?
It doesn't. Well, actually, I can put something on my table if people want to read something that's been written about it, and it can go that way. But it didn't seem that I was to speak about it here.
Were your studies internal or somehow external?
They were both. We actually had to apply whatever truth that we were working with. So it was something that you lived in your daily life. So there was a lot of transformation and changing that was taking place. But these were just like preliminary steps, it seemed like to me, a place to jump off from. But it was actually this longing and this sorrow and this intention that seemed to be, you know, the key for me. And I don't know if it was just a mixture, you know, of the two, which was very analytical and involved a lot of study and of scripture and a knowledge of God to a point where it became contemplative and it took on a more intuitive kind of quality after a while, where you weren't just like knowing from a book, but you were knowing from within yourself that comes. Everything is really within, is the only way that I can really describe it. And, you know, things in the outer picture can be aids, tools, you know, to help you. And like I said, just the intention of going within, you know, it seems, I mean, it was for me what was key. Just a deep, deep desire to go home. Thank you for coming. You made it easy. Thank you.